The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 87712, Bowen against Massachusetts, and 87929, Massachusetts against Bowen. Englert, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case presents jurisdictional questions. The Grant Appeals Board of the Department of Health and Human Services disallowed $11.3 million in federal financial participation under the Medicaid program to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The Commonwealth challenged that disallowance in the United States District Court for the District of Massachusetts, claiming that that court had jurisdiction. Our position is that the United States Claims Court had jurisdiction. The Court of Appeals agreed with each side in part. We petition this court to review the court's partial assertion of jurisdiction. The Commonwealth cross-petitioned to review the court's partial refusal to exercise jurisdiction. The petition and the cross-petition were both granted. By way of background, this case arises from two audits covering the years 1978 to 1982 of Massachusetts expenditures at intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded. Applying a long-standing HHS regulation, the auditors determined that Massachusetts had improperly claimed Medicare reimbursement for certain educational services that the State Department of Education was required to pay for. $11.3 million in federal financial participation was disallowed. That's a small fraction of the total federal financial participation for Massachusetts at these facilities in the years in question. As was its right, Massachusetts challenged that disallowance in the Grant Appeals Board, an entity created by regulation in 1973 to review disallowances on behalf of the Secretary. The Grant Appeals Board upheld the disallowances. The money has since been recouped by reducing certain Medicaid grants to Massachusetts in subsequent years. In response to the GAB decisions, Massachusetts filed complaints for judicial review in the district court. The Commonwealth recognized that there is no statute providing specifically for judicial review of disallowance decisions. The complaints did assert that 5 U.S.C. Section 702, a part of the Administrative Procedure Act, waives the sovereign immunity of the United States and permits this kind of action to proceed in district court. The district court said it had jurisdiction. The district court disagreed with the Grant Appeals Board decisions in their entirety, said that the Commonwealth was entitled to financial participation, federal financial participation for all of these services, and entered a judgment reversing the Grant Appeals Board. We appealed and argued, among other things, that the district court had entered a money judgment against the United States without any applicable waiver of sovereign immunity that permitted such a judgment. The problem with using 5 U.S.C. Section 702 as the applicable waiver of sovereign immunity is that that statute applies only to actions, quote, seeking relief other than money damages, close quote. We contend that the $11.3 million at issue here is money damages. Now, it's important to understand we were not arguing that the Grant Appeals Board decisions were unreviewable. Rather, our position was that the Tucker Act, which does waive sovereign immunity for money judgments, permitted an action in the United States Claims Court.
Now, Mr. Englert, there's a split of authority, isn't there, in the courts of appeal about whether money damages means compensatory damages or whether it refers to the Tucker Act, any monetary relief question?
There is a split in the circuits. Yes.
And the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia takes the view that money damages doesn't mean what you say it means in that statute.
That's correct. That court actually stands alone among the courts of appeals.
So that's really the crux of what we need to focus on, I suppose, in this case.
That's correct. That is the crux of the issue presented by the Commonwealth's cross petition, and we think it's really the crux of the issue presented by our petition, too. That question is addressed rather squarely in the legislative history of the 1976 amendments to the APA. When Congress used the phrase money damages, it meant monetary relief as opposed to declaratory injunctive mandamus relief.
Why do you suppose Congress didn't use language like is used in the Tucker Act if they intended it to mean the same thing?
Well, there actually is no language in the Tucker Act that refers to money damages. The Tucker Act is a very old statute, and the limitations on the powers of the claims court under the Tucker Act have been inferred from the surrounding context and not directly from the language of that statute. It's a very broadly written statute. In any event, I think the Congress took a proposal that was given to it by the Administrative Conference, a proposal that is backed up by numerous memoranda that often refer to all forms of monetary relief being excluded from the proposal. The Administrative Conference happened to use the words money damages, words that are not unnatural to use to describe all forms of monetary relief, and those are the words Congress enacted.
Well, I guess Judge Bork, in his opinion for the CADC, found some legislative history the other way.
Very little, Your Honor. He relied almost entirely on a single reference to granting aid programs in the House report and the Senate report. That reference is part of a long list of actions in which sovereign immunity had been asserted in the past and might not be asserted in the future under the APA amendments. Not every grant and aid program has to be not every grant and aid lawsuit has to be an action seeking the payment of money by the federal government.
Let me ask you on that point. Does a state in the position of Massachusetts have any ability to prevent recoupment by the government during the appeal process so that they wouldn't be in the position of needing to ask for the money back?
Some states have succeeded in preventing recoupment, albeit under an assertion of jurisdiction we think is invalid. We think they have no proper means to prevent recoupment.
So in your view, as a practical matter, a state will always be in the position of having to seek money damages, in effect, and always be channeled to the Court of Claims in any of these grant programs. So when they want an interpretation of the statutory language, in the government's view, they're always going to be channeled to the Court of Claims.
No, Your Honor. Suppose the Secretary promulgated a new regulation, and before that ever took effect, it was to take effect January 1st, 89, and then on April 20th of 1988, the state brought a prospective challenge to that regulation. Say the Secretary did something outrageous like promulgating a regulation saying there will be no further reimbursement for intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded period. There's no accrued monetary claim in that case, and there's not going to be an accrued monetary claim during the initial pendency of the lawsuit. And the district, we have no problem with letting the district courts address that and to grant declaratory and injunctive.
Well, would you have trouble with just a declaratory judgment that says, here's the situation, we're in a disagreement with the government on this issue. We don't ask for an injunction now or any money or anything else. We just want a judgment. We think the Secretary will live up to the judgment.
If they don't want money and don't ask for
money. They don't ask for it. But if there's a judgment, they're probably then going to go to the Court of Claims.
Well, but
and the issue will the legal issue will have been settled.
But the ordinary rules of res judicata, as we understand them, preclude that kind of claim splitting, first getting your judgment in one court and then bringing a separate claim in another court.
Well, I'm just asking you, would you object to just a declaratory judgment?
Standing alone, we wouldn't, although we would object if they were then successful in transforming that into a money judgment for past due money in the claims court, yes.
What is the district court who gets something like that supposed to do? I recall confronting this on the D.C. Circuit. Are you supposed to deem that to include a claim for monetary relief or not? I mean, the usual rule, what court you're in is to be judged on the basis of the complaint, right? And a complaint is to be deemed amended to show that you get all the relief that the proof entitles you to. And when you're asking for a declaratory judgment in a matter where it's clear that the effect of that declaratory judgment will entitle you to money, I assume, without any amendment of the complaint at all, the court that enters the declaratory judgment ought to enter an order for the money relief as well, shouldn't it?
I think that's right. And I think
so really what you say is that the state can bring the action if they specifically disclaim any desire for monetary relief, not just bring it purely for a declaratory judgment, but say, we are asking only for a declaratory judgment and we waive all right to monetary relief.
We do think that's the better view. An alternative view would be to say that the state may bring the claim but is foreclosed from later seeking money. But we think the view you just stated is the better approach.
But there is a way to do it.
There is a way to do it.
So you think the government, if there was a declaratory judgment, which you didn't object to, you think the government would then still refuse to refund the money?
If
it had been adjudged finally in a court that the secretary had been wrong all the way?
If we thought that the state had brought the action in district court to secure district court jurisdiction over an action that should have been in the claims court, if the state wanted money, I think we might very well take that position.
Well,
yes.
The state didn't ask for money. It even disclaims it didn't want any money. But
well, if they say they don't want any money, we're not going to give them any money.
Even though you had just been, you had been unlawful all the way.
If the state said it didn't want it and secured jurisdiction in that manner, we wouldn't see any reason to.
Well, Mr. Englert, there is some legislative history, as you've acknowledged, that indicates that Congress did expect these grant and aid programs to be decided in the district courts and the courts of appeal.
Well, as I say, there's a single reference to grant and aid programs in both committee reports. Justice O'Connor, not all challenges to administration of grant and aid programs involve seeking money from the federal government. A good example is Bowen v. Kendrick, which this court heard just last month. That certainly is a challenge to the federal government's administration of a grant and aid program. It's a contention that the statute under which that program is administered violates the Establishment Clause.
Oh, yes, but most of these issues come up and involve money. That's why the states are worried about it. That's why the grantees are worried. And there is certainly some indication that Congress thought that these issues were better resolved in the crucible of the federal district courts and the courts of appeal, where they can give a considered judgment to these questions. And to channel all that stuff to the claims court just seems to me to be a very troublesome view of the matter.
Well, I must respectfully disagree with you in several respects. Certainly, the claims court and the Federal Circuit can give considered judgment to these things, to these issues.
Would you speak up just a little bit?
I'm sorry. Certainly, the claims court and its appellate court, the Federal Circuit, can give considered judgment to these matters. There's nothing less competent about the claims court and the Federal Circuit than about the district courts and the regional courts of appeals.
No, but it's often very helpful, of course, to have different circuit courts of appeal focus in on some very tough issues that we get.
That's correct, of course, Your Honor. But also, the whole purpose of the claims court and the Federal Circuit is to centralize certain matters.
Well, that could happen under the Tucker Act, too. Don't forget that. Below $10,000, even if it's under the Tucker Act, it'll arise in the district courts.
But then we'll go to the Federal
Circuit.
We'll
go to the Federal Circuit. But you'll have district courts other than the claims court.
But pursuing Justice O'Connor's point a little bit, this case involves a problem really peculiar to Massachusetts because they have a difference in the way between the Department of Education and the Department of Mental Health and how they handle certain things. Isn't this one of those kinds of cases where there's perhaps some benefit in having the regional circuits, which perhaps have better understanding of the various states within their circuits, a way of handling governmental matters such as this, having them to... I really don't quite understand why I understand you want to have the statute interpreted according to the intent of Congress, but from a practical standpoint, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have this kind of case in the regional circuit rather than in the Court of Claims.
Well, there are policy arguments that can be made to send these cases to various places. There are also policy arguments that can be made in favor of centralizing all large money claims against the United States in one court, and that is what we think the Tucker Act and the APA dovetail to do. The APA waiver explicitly excludes actions for money damages.
Well, it isn't all that clear. It applies to all actions seeking relief other than money damages. And I'm not sure if one reads that language literally, and you have an action which seeks A, declaratory judgment, which is relief other than money damages, and also seeks money damages. A literal reading of the language would not necessarily foreclose jurisdiction.
A literal reading of that language would not necessarily by itself foreclose jurisdiction.
Right.
But there are two other things at work here. One is the overall intent of Congress, which we do think is to put money cases one place and non-money cases another. The other is Section 704, which allows non-statutory review, which is what we have here, only when there is no other adequate remedy in a court. And a money action in the claims court certainly is an adequate remedy in the circumstances of this case. The Court of Appeals, which didn't address Section 704, thought that it was appropriate to entertain the so-called declaratory aspects of this case. It affirmed what it called a declaratory judgment, merely because the Grant Appeals Board decisions are precedents. That's the only significant prospective effect, as the Court called it, that there was that justified splitting of the claim into two courts. But all judicial decisions are precedents. The claims court decision on the money claim would be a precedent, and if the claims court agreed with Massachusetts, the Grant Appeals Board decision would be reversed just as effectively as as it was by the district court. The remedy that exists in the claims court is perfectly adequate. And it's for that reason that on the issue in our petition, the claim splitting issue, we think it's quite clear.
You rely primarily on 704 rather than 702.
On that issue, that's correct. And also on our overall perception of the intent of Congress, which has one statute that's been on the books since 1887 that allows money actions to be brought against the federal government, and another statute that excludes money damages, with a lot of legislative history backing it up to say that means
all
monetary
relief. Isn't it true as a matter of history that some of these cases that the government did not take the position you're taking now, that they allowed some of these cases to go forward in the district courts outside of the Court of Claims?
That's correct. The issue was not addressed.
It wasn't as obvious as it is now.
Did the government raise this argument at the district court level in this case?
Yes, but.
What?
We said the Secretary has decided as a matter of policy not to pursue objections to jurisdiction in this case. Of course, that's something that we couldn't bind the court to accept jurisdiction by making that unfortunate statement. Issue was resolved on the merits by the district court.
Mr. Englert, let me also ask you whether you think the 704 adequate remedy question determination should be made case by case or on the basis of categories of things.
I don't think it can be made in an absolute sense for any and all cases for all times. Certainly there are categories of cases, and we think grant disallowance cases involving accrued monetary claims are a category of cases in which that claims court remedy will, in all cases, we would think, be adequate because... Even though prospective relief is sought...
And even though you might have changing administrations and new administrators and different policies in the future, and you just think people ought to be foreclosed from getting that prospective relief order.
Yes, because it's not the government's position that matters, it's the court's position that matters. And when the claims court, in adjudicating the money claim, decides an issue of law, that's binding on the federal government in all future dealings with the same party. The claims court is a perfectly competent court to address these issues, as it has in Medicare cases, in other kinds of judicial review actions in the past.
Where is the legislative history referring to grant and aids cases that you were discussing with Justice O'Connor earlier? That came up in what context?
Page 8 of the Senate report and also page 9 of the virtually identical House report. The sentence is, the doctrine has been invoked in hundreds of cases each year concerning agriculture, the doctrine meaning the doctrine of sovereign immunity, has been invoked in hundreds of cases each year concerning agricultural regulations, governmental employment, tax investigations, postal rate matters, administration of labor legislation, control of subversive activities, food and drug regulation, and administration of federal grant and aid programs.
But it was assuredly not invoked in money claims under grant and aid programs. I mean, it's impossible to interpret it to be referring to any invocation when there had been a money claim. Money claims in grant and aid programs would have come under the Tucker Act, even before this amendment to the APA, right?
That would have been our position, yes.
So I don't see how it, you know, I don't see how it gives you any problem at all. You seem to acknowledge that it gives you some problem.
Well, no, we acknowledge that Judge Bork rested his entire analysis on that snippet of legislative history. And we acknowledge that many grant and aid cases will involve money claims. But our position is, Justice Scalia, that the Tucker Act would have been the appropriate vehicle for money claims and grant and aid cases before and after
This reference must mean challenges to pre-issuance challenge to regulations, which is how a lot of grant and aid claims come up, of course, when the regulations are proposed, finally adopted, and someone takes them up to challenge them, or tries to.
I think that's a proper construction. In candor, I have to say that you can trace that reference back to two cases cited in Professor Crampton's memorandum for the administrative conference, and those were not pre-enforcement challenges to regulations. They were, as we read them, challenges to deferral of action on grant applications by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. That's how we read them. Our opponents read them differently, and the cases are, I admit, rather
opaque. Yes, I recall that the briefs seemed to disagree on that.
Did the claim for the money relief here precisely track the claim for injunctive and prospective relief? I could see that it would seem to me that sometimes with grant and aid programs, the state would be objecting to an overall interpretation of a regulation and seek prospective relief, and then there would be some discrete instances where they would want money back, and it seems to me that the two might not track each other.
I'm not sure that such cases would arise, but that would be a different case from this one. This one is a case, Justice Kennedy, in which the only prospective effect that the Court of Appeals identified was that the Grant Appeals Board decision stood as precedent. And the only prospective relief that any court granted is what the Court of Appeals called so much of the judgment below as constitutes a declaratory judgment that the Secretary's blanket special education exclusion is in excess of statutory authority. In other words, that was the underlying issue that the claims court would have resolved, the district court did resolve, the claims court would have resolved if this money case had been brought there in the first place.
The First Circuit said that the claims court, in the claims court, its judgment would be collateral estoppel. Do you accept that proposition? Can the government be collaterally estopped?
Well, the government can be collaterally estopped under the Stouffer Chemical and Montana cases.
So if the First Circuit is correct, then there is estoppel in the claims court? You concede that?
No. We think the usual rule is that when an action is brought in one court and then a separate claim that could have is split from that and brought in a separate court, that the plaintiff loses all right to proceed on that separate claim. It's complicated here because the plaintiff
I'm saying let's assume for the moment that we affirm the First Circuit and its reasoning. Would you then concede that you are collaterally estopped in the claims court?
No.
I didn't
think so. I doubt we would have a lot of luck in the claims court. But we wouldn't concede the point. We would still fight it.
Res judicata certainly wouldn't apply if the court didn't have jurisdiction to enter the money judgment.
Well, of course, but the premise of Justice Kennedy's question was that this court affirmed the mm-hmm. First Circuit in its reasoning. Mm-hmm.
Well, it set aside the money judgment, didn't it?
The court did set aside the money judgment.
On the grounds that?
On the ground that our analysis of the legislative history of the Administrative Procedure Act is correct, that the court to enter money judgments against the United States is the claims court, and that the other than money damages provision of the APA excludes this action from district court jurisdiction.
May I ask you a question? Maybe it's a little out of line, but supposing we granted cert to review the merits of the issue as well as the jurisdictional questions, and we had decided that, A, the Court of Appeals did have jurisdiction to decide the legal issue and that they were right on that issue, and then we said nothing about the money, wouldn't the government pay the money to the state, or would they insist, would they take this position that there's a legal defense so we won't pay it even though the state was entitled to it?
Well, the problem wouldn't be collateral estoppel. The problem would be that the highest court in the land.
It isn't just collateral estoppel. It's really how one thinks the government should operate when a Supreme Court of the United States has held that they violated the law, and they could even often we used to have cases where we wouldn't enjoin state officials. We entered declaratory judgments on the assumption that the state would accept the rule of law. But the government, you're telling me, if I understand you correctly, that the executive department would say, well, they don't have a legal right to get it, even though we know we have no legal right to retain it, so we're going to make them litigate for it?
Justice Stevens, I said that in the context of a question whose underlying premise was the state brought an action in which it disclaimed the right to monetary relief. It was so important to the state to get into the district court rather than the claims court that the state was willing to forego its monetary
claim. My hypothesis was this very case, and we only decided the issue they decided. And you'd say your position would be the government would still keep the money, if I understand you.
The
regulatory decision made by the Secretary was erroneous and violated the statute. And if we had affirmed that on the merits and didn't say anything about money, you're suggesting to me that the Secretary wouldn't pay the state the money that they now say they have?
In the context of this case, in which the state has never made any secret of the fact that it wants the money, and this court accepted jurisdiction and held against us, no, of course we'd pay the money.
You would. You would not then make the collateral estoppel. You would not say, well, they'd split their cause of action so they, even though they go to the Court of Claims. I thought you were saying that we would make the defense they should have, that this cause of action was split and they can't get relief.
No, the point is, Justice Stevens, we might make the collateral estoppel argument, but we'd be foolish to re-argue the merits in the claims court, which, of course, would be bound by this court's disposition
on
the merits.
My point is that if you're wrong on the merits, regardless of the technicalities of whether there's collateral estoppel, I mean, we're talking about government decisions. We're not talking about private litigation between private parties. The executive department would still say they want to keep the money.
Justice Stevens, my answer to the questions about collateral estoppel was that we would argue against collateral estoppel so that we could relitigate in the claims court, not so that we could.
That's why I asked you if we had decided whether you'd still do that. So there would be nothing more to relitigate on the merits.
Right, and then we would pay.
You would.
Yes. I'd like, if I may, to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Englert. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Barnico.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the importance of circuit court review that was discussed earlier in the argument isn't, as Mr. Englert suggests, just a question of a policy preference. In fact, as one of the justices has pointed out and one of the amicus briefs has addressed, there is a certain familiarity that circuit courts develop with a given state's Medicaid plan and disputes that might arise either between states or between the secretary and the state in this case. But the more important point that I wish to address on that score is that Congress has provided evidence that it believes that the circuit court's role is important in these cases. And that is that, and it can't be disputed here, that when Congress addressed the question of judicial review of disputes between the secretary and the states under the Medicaid program, it expressly authorized states to bring petitions to the circuit courts to review instances in which the secretary has found that states or their plans or their amendments to their state plans are not in compliance with the Medicaid Act.
Now, what provision of the statute is that you're relying on?
Mr. Chief Justice, that is 42 U.S.C. section 1316A3.
And where is that in your brief?
That appears in the appendix to the brief, the statutory appendix to the brief, Your Honor.
Roman numeral 12.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the point we wish to make is that there is no, for jurisdictional purposes, and as we try to determine congressional intent over these actions, there's no significant difference between the action of the Secretary involved here and the kind of action that arises when the Secretary finds that the state or an amendment to a plan doesn't comply with the Medicaid Act.
But that's often true of the cases that go to the claims court and to the Federal Circuit under the Tucker Act. The jurisdiction is not based on subject matter. It's based on whether there's a monetary claim. They have a wide diversity of subject matters. They get into every kind of issue you can imagine. So I don't see what this proves. It just proves that this litigation, like all other litigation, can arise in either of those courts.
No, but, Your Honor, it proves more than that, because as the Secretary points out, there's a lack of a specific statute providing for review of disallowances. We turn to the statutory context to determine under what statute a state can bring an action and under what statute Congress has waived sovereign immunity. And that judgment's informed partially by the statute that governs the waiver in this section 702, but it's also governed by the overall statutory context. Because if the Secretary is correct, it means that Congress somehow chose to divert cases such as ours, the disallowance cases, from the local courts, the district courts and the circuit courts, and send them to a more specialized, centralized forum like the claims court and like the Federal Circuit. And we think that's a reading of the statutory context that can't be supported.
Of course, 42 U.S.C. 1316 sends you to the Court of Appeals.
That's right.
You didn't go to the Court of Appeals, sir. You went to the district court.
No.
District court anyway. I mean, that's just a special statutory provision.
There's a reason
dealing
why.
Dealing with quite different situations.
There's a reason why we went to the district court.
Because this is a special statute. The APA reads that where there's a special statute, you go to the court that the special statute prescribes, and in the absence of a special statute, you go to district court. It wasn't a strategic determination on your part. You had to go there, didn't you?
Not entirely, Your Honor.
Well,
in this case, we went to the district court because, as I've said, it was the result of earlier litigation with the Secretary over the question of whether a given dispute between the states and the Secretary was a compliance matter or a disallowance matter. In those cases that were litigated all over the country, circuit courts roughly determined that certain questions that arose under the program were indeed compliance matters. But in those cases, the Secretary represented to the various circuit courts of appeal around the country that he would not contest district court jurisdiction over the same cases. So it was not surprising that in this case that not only did we identify 702 as the source of the waiver, but that we proceeded in the district courts. Mm-hmm. It was upon the Secretary's representation to the First Circuit that he would not contest district court jurisdiction over the same case.
Well, as 1316 is concerned, it seems to me it hurts you more than it helps you. It's a statement by the Congress that you can go directly to the circuit courts if you have a question of interpretation at the outset. You begin your argument with 1316. It seems to me that's not a very strong point.
Well, Your Honor, it is, because it's not simply a question at the outset. Compliance matters could be as close to this case as the following example. That is, if we had not provided these services to our mentally retarded in the past, and we proposed to amend our Medicaid plan to include these services and made it the basis for a specific amendment, and the Secretary denied the amendment on the same ground that he invoked here, that is, that when we train people to eat, that's education in nature and outside the scope of the Act. Now, in that event, we would have had an appeal to the Circuit Court on the same record, testing the question of whether the Secretary had erroneously read the Medicaid Act to exclude those services. So, and furthermore, Your Honor, those cases could also implicate money as well, because under the Secretary's regulations, if you are successful through the administrative process and we presume through the judicial process in successfully overturning the denial of an amendment, you are entitled to a lump sum covering the services back to the time that the amendment was submitted. So with all respect, Your Honor, it does not merely address situations where the state wishes to identify a legal issue at the threshold and litigate that question before any injury occurs. This also...
You're entitled to a lump sum under 1316?
No, Your Honor.
Where do you get the lump sum?
Lump sum, Your Honor, is mentioned in 45 CFR, Section 201.3.
Regulation.
It's a regulation. But, you know, this also implicates the previous response of my brother to the question of a district court action which merely tests the validity of a regulation. By way of background, one of the reasons why these disallowance cases are growing is that the Secretary chooses to implement policy judgments through the disallowance mechanism rather than to specifically state through regulations what services are covered and which are not. And so when the court considered the case a few terms ago of the Connecticut, a similar Connecticut state agency against the Secretary, the Connecticut cited the same sort of broad disallowance that carried a prospective effect and implications for further services given by that state. So it may be well for Mr. Engler to say that in the abstract, certain cases can still proceed when states challenge regulations under a particular grant and aid program. But it's very much part of this record that the disallowance procedure is used for far different purposes than a technical audit or the adjustment of accounting error. It's used, as both of the lower courts found, to make prospective, coercive judgments about the scope of the Medicaid Act. The states are forced at that point to decide if they would, once they receive that first disallowance, and while they're still in the administrative process before the Grant Appeals Board, the states are forced to make a judgment about whether they should continue to provide those services, knowing that they have an exposure, that the millions of dollars that they spend could well be disallowed at some indeterminate time in the future. And faced with that kind of situation in that kind of relationship, it's important that we be able to go to the district courts to secure declaratory and injunctive relief that would bind the parties in our future relationship. The Court of Appeals, if I might read just one excerpt from the decision, said that the Commonwealth's requested injunction is not specific to the retrospective 1978-1982 reimbursement disallowed by the Secretary. Rather, it stretches into the future, as does the legal relationship between the parties. And that's the relief that we sought, and that's the relief that our complaint sets out.
Do you think that the government would not have been bound with respect to its future action on the same matter had you gotten your judgment from the Federal Circuit under the Tucker Act instead of from Court of Appeals here?
I would not expect them to act as if they were bound in the same way. I think Your Honor is suggesting that
the same issue involving the same party, well, the case that had just been...
Your Honor, I think the point is that whether the effect of stare decisis alone in such a context would be enough. And I don't think their past conduct gives us that kind of assurance. And as a matter of law, I think it's different as well. This, as a matter of record before this court, the Secretary has, in disallowances which have followed the Massachusetts disallowance and have followed the opinion of the First Circuit in this case, has simply disagreed with the First Circuit and disallowed reimbursement to, I believe it's Utah and Tennessee.
But in a system where you're going to regional courts of appeals, that's understandable. I think Justice Scalia's hypothesis was, if you go to the Federal Circuit, presumably all this kind of cases are going to the Federal Circuit. So the government wouldn't be entitled to say, well, that may be the rule in Massachusetts, but it's not in Utah. If the Federal Circuit says it and handles these cases, that's going to be the rule for the whole United States.
Well, I would still distinguish that from that binding order that we think, and it may well be the difference between relief that we consider essential that and what the Secretary deems as adequate. The point about the Federal Circuit.
The statute says if that you can get into the district court only if there is no other adequate remedy.
That's
correct. It isn't his judgment about what's adequate, but rather it's the Congress's and ultimately the courts, I suppose.
That's right. At the threshold, there's a disagreement between some of the circuits and the Secretary's interpretation of Section 704, but I understand that there is a statutory basis for that point. The point addressed in the briefs, though, thoroughly, I believe, is that in many respects, the claims court won't be able to provide the declaratory and injunctive relief the beneficiaries and states believe would be necessary to govern the relationship in such programs.
Well, Mr. Barnicle, in this case now, the district court did not issue an injunction. Is that right?
The district court entered a judgment that said that the decision of the secretary was reversed.
It did not enter an injunction, did it?
No.
And you take the position that to be adequate, the relief requires an injunction, and that's why it doesn't meet the standards of 704, shouldn't go to the Court of Claims, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And yet you ask us at the same time to reinstate the judgment of the district court, which didn't issue an injunction. So how, in this case, do you find it wasn't adequate?
In this case, we don't necessarily say that the relief would be inadequate. To the extent that in such cases, our first position will always be that we'll expect the Secretary to abide by a judgment of reversal and whatever declaration of law accompanies the reversal.
In this case, the relief in the Court of Claims might well be adequate and the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit.
Well, acknowledging that not necessarily, Your Honor, because the Court of Appeals entered relief that is much more in the nature of an injunction than the district court. But my second point would be that in this case, we were content with the judgment of reversal, but we asked for more, and there was no indication from any court that we weren't entitled to more. But as we tried to respectfully suggest in the brief, upon such a reversal, we judge that to be adequate in the absence of some action by the Secretary that he won't abide. Now, as our briefs at the petition stage suggested, it's going to be the district court that we'll want to go to for a coercive order in the event that the Secretary doesn't abide by the reversal and and by the declaration of law that accompanies the reversal.
No one in your client's position is going to ask in the district court for money damages. And there will just be requests for declaratory judgment and prospective relief. No money, no request for money damages. And there is no other forum. There isn't a forum in the Court of Claims for just to go get declaratory judgments.
No. The Claims Court would throw out, I imagine, a case that sought only declaratory relief.
Exactly.
Now, the discussion, excuse me.
Well, we're sort of confronted with how to interpret the Tucker Act, not just in this context, but elsewhere. What is the line that you're drawing as to what doesn't constitute monetary relief? Is it just in this narrow area of benefits denied by the government? Or is it whenever you come to a district court in any case and don't ask for money, just ask for a declaratory judgment or an injunction? That would be disastrous, right?
In the latter case, you couldn't go to the district court for declaratory and injunctive relief that is prohibited by some other statute. That's one of the other limitations that the Secretary identifies.
Well, what do you mean by prohibited by? It's not prohibited anywhere else. It's just that you have a claim,
right,
a claim for money damages, and you choose instead to apply for a declaratory judgment that the Secretary owes you money. Would you allow that?
It would depend on the context, Your Honor. In the grant and aid context, I think you're referring to really a rule that the First Circuit set out in the sense that they would measure the amount of prospective relief. Now, we don't happen to agree with that approach. And so in the grant and aid context, you would, at least the district court would be able to rely on the legislative history of the APA that identified the grant and aid programs as one example of the kind of case that they wished to have brought in the district court.
But they're surely just an example. I mean, the government's proposal has the advantage of being a clear line. I'm not sure what your line is, except that grant and aid things are covered. But you can't draw the line there, is what you're saying. So long as you don't ask for money, you don't have to go to the claims court, or what? What is the line you want us to adopt?
Well, the line relies on a couple of factors. I can't draw it as clearly as what I consider to be the simplistic line of any case that happens to involve money belongs in the claims court. On the other hand, there are identifiable factors that the court...
I hope. This is a jurisdictional question. The worst thing in the world to waste time litigating is whether you should have been in the claims court or in the district court. And it doesn't just arise in the district level, but then you have to decide which of the two courts of appeals you should have gone to.
Honor, I couldn't agree more about the waste of time, and it's only complicated by changes of position from the government, I might add. But in any event, I suggest that the court has already identified at least one of the factors in its own consideration of the Tucker Act. I'm thinking of the case of U.S. versus Matos, where the court made a fairly strong statement that the complaint is an important aspect of a judgment of a court about jurisdiction, and so that at least the court would consider what kind of case is made by the plaintiff and what relief is requested. Now, that implicates...
Mr. Barnico, I take it you don't urge the adoption of the line drawn by the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia Circuit. That money damages refers to a sum of money used as compensatory relief. You're not urging that line.
No, we're not. But we're urging something similar. The brief refers to what we call non-monetary relief, and there's no dispute that the district court is available for such relief. I don't think that the District of Columbia Circuit had anything different in mind when it said that when a court makes a judgment that an administrator has violated the law, it's making a specific remedy when it orders or its judgment requires that administrator to turn over the money. I think that the kind of relief and the line that we suggest is in the same nature and produces the same result. But I think that the decision of the District of Columbia Circuit had more to do with prying a certain kind of monetary relief away from the term money damages.
Can your test be stated in one sentence?
Cases brought for injunctive and declaratory relief against adjudicatory decisions under grant and aid programs are within the jurisdiction of the district courts under the waiver of sovereign immunity contained in Section 702.
And what if they include a prayer for money judgment against the government?
If then the rule it takes more than one sentence, I'm afraid. And when the court considers that complaint in its entirety against the overall statutory context of the subject matter, it makes a determination that the district court is the court that will hear such a case.
Well, why shouldn't the district court just say, do you want to stay in this court or not? And if you do, you better withdraw your claim for money damages.
Well, that's similar. That would depend, Your Honor, on whether it's merely a...
That just really raises the question whether the Court of Appeals was correct.
Right. And it raises the question of whether the state is going to be required to make a binding waiver of any monetary recovery versus...
It doesn't have to have a binding waiver. Right. The district court just says, I'm not going to entertain this claim for money damages. I don't have jurisdiction to do that.
And it may require that litigant to just simply drop whatever prayer suggests the money judgment.
What kind of a prayer suggests that, by the way? You know, there's the boilerplate at the end of every complaint, which says, and such other relief as may be appropriate.
Right.
What if money damages are appropriate? Is that a prayer for money damages?
I wouldn't think it would be a prayer enough to defeat the jurisdiction of the district court, no.
You think everybody would think that? Adopt a rule like that or something? Can we train pleaders to put in or not put in that provision?
No, and pleaders are often faced with different kinds of pressures. And in this case, the complaint was written before we knew that the Tucker Act even applied to, could be argued that it could be applied to such a case. Now, the last point I'd like to make today has to do with the relationship between the federal circuits on the one hand and the circuit courts of appeal on the other. Congress intended that the federal circuit and the claims court have a specialized subject matter. The Federal Courts Improvement Act that was enacted by Congress in 1982 demonstrates that Congress has always sought to preserve the circuit courts of appeals as courts of general jurisdiction in terms of subject matter. The legislative history of that act, we think, is very important to the case and provides further statutory context to decide our case. There was no indication in the legislative history of the Federal Courts Improvement Act that suggests Congress ever believed that the Federal Circuit would become a national forum for resolution of questions under the Social Security Act.
But Congress could just as easily, and I think the government argues here, have allocated jurisdiction on the basis that we want all claims for money judgment against the government to be tried in the claims court and go to the Federal Circuit. Now, that means the Federal Circuit will be expounding on lots of different areas of the law, but the unifying factor would be the money judgment against the government.
That is his competing argument on intent, and there's authority for the proposition that Congress intended to centralize some cases or cases involving money, according to the solicitor, and that we happen to fall in those cases. My point is that rubs right up against Congress's express intent to keep the circuit courts of appeal available for the kind of general questions of important social policy like the Social Security.
Well, of course, your position means that the government can go around every circuit relitigating the same issue.
And apparently they're doing it in this very
Well, I know, but in a way it's strange that the government wants to be able to litigate it only once.
Well, they must have their reasons. But I think that their result is inconsistent with judgments that Congress has made about the subject matters of the cases that will arise and be heard by the courts that were created in 1982. Finally, I should make the point that the court has previously identified at least one consequence of litigating in the claims court, and that is that when you litigate in the claims court, ordinarily you litigate in Washington. And for the court to adopt the view of the solicitor in this case is to impute to Congress the intent that beneficiaries or states who have disputes with the Secretary that involve money under the Medicaid Act will be litigating their cases in Washington. And we don't think that's an intent that's supported by any of the legislative history.
Does Massachusetts have an office here in Washington?
I believe the governor has a small office.
I think most states do. I don't think that would be so horrible.
I think the point is much more important as to the beneficiaries, Your Honor, and it's made by an amicus brief in that respect.
It's under $10,000. They can bring the suit in district court.
The Little Tucker Act applies, but many of the class actions that are brought by legal service organizations on behalf of those beneficiaries, some of which happen to involve the states as defendants, would ordinarily involve more money than that. In conclusion, Congress waived sovereign immunity for these cases, and there's no question about that. But Congress didn't intend to centralize cases such as this in courts that were created in 1982 that have no expertise in this particular area. Congress intended that we could bring these cases in our local district courts, and this court should so hold. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Barnicle. Mr. Englert, you have 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. If a district court said to the plaintiff, waive or drop your monetary claim so that you can stay here, with the intent that the plaintiff would recover money at the end of the day, we think that's at best a conscious evasion of the jurisdictional scheme Congress has created. We also think it's precluded by Section 704 because the person who wants that money can pursue his action for that money in the claims court. The claims court and federal circuit are not, never have been, specialized subject matter courts. The Tucker Act is not subject matter specific. There are limitations on what actions can be brought under the Tucker Act, but they depend on the form of relief sought and whether there exists a money mandating statute, not on general subject matter. The Tucker Act, like the APA, cuts across all subject matters. Finally, I don't think it's relevant to any issue before this court whether the states have to come to Washington to litigate or not. But 28 U.S.C. 44 allows the Federal Circuit to sit anywhere that any court of appeals can sit. 28 U.S.C. Section 173 allows the claims court to sit anywhere in the nation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Englert. The case is submitted.